So last week I talked about Milarepa. For those that weren't here or who are not familiar with him, he was a great Tibetan poet, mystic, yogi. So he lived in the wilds and the mountains. He was lived very, very simply. He lived in caves, wandered from place to place. Sometimes in the mountains, sometimes he'd come down to villages and towns and meet with people. He was like a kind of troubadour. There was this tradition of poets that would sing their songs. I don't think we have any of the tunes that he sung them to, but apparently he did sing these poems. So a lot of his teaching was done through the medium of songs. I'm not going to attempt, if you're pleased to hear, to do any of that this evening. But I think, you know, this gives us some general flavour of him. You can think of him as a kind of wild man in the mountains who sings of his joy and his renunciant lifestyle. So, oh, and the date is around 1066. I all remember that because it's easy to remember. So he was born just before the Battle of Hastings and continued to teach for about 50 years afterwards. So, teaching. I'm talking about Milarepa's teaching. So what precisely do I mean by teaching in this context? Teaching the Dharma, teaching Buddhism, can happen in all sorts of different ways. We can have the communication of information. So teaching things about ethics, teaching what the five precepts are, what the ten precepts are, what the six paramitas are, what the eight paramitas are, and so on. These things just need explaining. They need communicating in a very practical manner. We also need to learn meditation techniques, specific techniques. You know, you sit down, you bring your mind onto your breathing, you count your breathing from one to ten, you count your breathing, you know, before and after, and so on. We've got very specific practices. Those have to be taught in a very practical way. And similarly, Buddhist doctrine and so-called metaphysics has to be taught in a very sort of conceptual, intellectual, practical way. So this is one level of teaching, the communication of ideas. And you could say that this is the essential basis for all practice of the Dharma. You've got to know these things. You've got to be familiar with the precepts, with the meditation practices, with the doctrines, and so on. However, it's not just enough to know them. What one then has to do is to practice them. So there's another level of teaching that comes in here, where these ideas, these sort of practical things, are put into practice. So the teacher in this case can help to guide these practices. Okay, so first precept is that you cease to do harm to living beings. Well, what does that actually mean? What does it actually mean in your life? Discussing this with your spiritual friends can help you to understand this much more deeply, can you know, encourage you to practice it more deeply as time goes on. So there's this kind of teaching, the kind of teaching that guides in the principles and practices that one has learned in a very practical sense. But there's another level of teaching as well, and this occurs when somebody who has experienced liberation, let's say, or at least experienced some degree of liberation, is able to communicate their experience. They're able, through one means or another, to communicate to oneself that state, that experience, that liberation. And this, in a way, is the work of the poets. This is what poets, some people say that all Dharma is poetry, and in a way it is. But quite specifically, it's what certain teachers, of whom Milarepa is a prime example, they communicate their experience. They communicate the fact that they have thrown off some of the shackles of samsara and that they are free, liberated. Now that communication is a kind of resonance with oneself. There is deep within us, this is not metaphysics, this is poetry, there is deep within us a Buddha waiting to respond to something that comes from outside. So if Milarepa, for example, is talking about his liberation, and we listen to that, we can feel it touching something within us. Don't take this too literally. We can feel some tuning fork within our being, as it were, resonate to what he's saying. And that is very inspiring, because when that happens, we know that it's within us, that it's something within us that we just need to develop, evoke, practice, live in accordance with, and so on. So Milarepa is primarily, I would say, a teacher of this nature. He's a poet who communicates his own liberation, and that liberation resonates with his hearers and inspires them to greater practice. He's not particularly known for delineating, you know, the precepts clearly or particular meditation practices clearly. He's much more known for his inspiring qualities. So, what is it that he communicates? What is this liberation that he communicates? I'll be reading some of his teachings, and hopefully some of that will communicate as we go through this evening. But you could say that the qualities, the main qualities that he communicates, which I touched on last week, are simplicity. His whole being, his whole life is very, very simple. Way beyond what we can imagine as simple, but just very profoundly simple. Another characteristic is his freedom. He's completely liberated. He's completely independent. He's not shackled by anything. He wanders free in the mountains. Some say he could fly. Maybe, maybe not. But at least in some ways he could fly. He was free from the constraints of gravity, even, possibly, let's say, for the sake of argument. So, he lived in the mountains, but he didn't restrict himself to the mountains. Sometimes he came down to villages. Sometimes he went down into the valleys. Sometimes he would go to inns. Sometimes he would go to wedding parties. Sometimes he would just meet people on the road. Sometimes he would meet shepherds. Sometimes he would meet hunters in the mountains. Sometimes he would go off with various gods and goddesses, mainly goddesses actually, in the mountains. So we can make of that what we will. So he's free, he's simple. His life has got a kind of purity. You get the sense that there's no sort of, there's nothing dark about him. He's very sort of light and pure. Not pure in a sort of puritanical sense, but pure in the sense of pure water. He's like, his whole being is sort of crystal clear. There's nothing hidden, no darkness there. He's also very kind. In his relationship to everybody, he's kind. Although it must be said at times that kindness develops into compassion, which can be quite strong. He doesn't mince his words. I'll give you some examples of this later on. So he's got these kind of qualities: simplicity, freedom, independence, purity, kindness, compassion. And when he communicates this, as he does through many of his songs, it evokes this, as I said, within us. We respond to it. And this this kind of response is universally relevant. This is why someone from, I mean, the Tibetan culture of 1,000 years ago is so alien to anything that we might know anything about. And yet his words communicate very, very directly to us. They don't seem bound up within, some of them do, but a lot of them don't seem too bound up within a cultural context. And so they can speak to us, modern Westerners, 1,000 years later. It's quite remarkable, utterly, utterly remarkable, actually. So let's have a look at some of these teachings and get some examples. First of all, he has an appreciation of nature. Now, this kind of appreciation of nature is shared by many Asian renunciants, especially in China and Japan. A lot of Chinese poetry is about the beauty of nature, and it's also quite often written by hermits. In fact, this very day, I was listening to the Reef Lectures, the last of the four Reef Lectures, by, and I have written his name down, Kwame Anthony Appiah. I wasn't familiar with him before, but he writes a lot about the nature of identity and the need for a loosening up of identity. So, you know, could be a kind of Buddhist, really. Anyway, he gave the Reef Lectures and talked about four different sort of forms of identity. And he also declared that his fondness for Basho. Now, Basho is a Japanese hermit poet, very similar to Miller Epperin, many ways. He's said to be sometimes the inventor of haiku. You know, these beautiful, short, simple poems that communicate sort of purity and liberation. So, these characters, you know, they spent their time hanging around on mountains, doing nothing in particular except talking to people, and yet hundreds, thousand years later, we are still strongly influenced by them. So let's just read one of these songs. I'm going to read a fair number of these songs, so... I pray to my Guru, the Holy One. Listen, my patrons, and I will tell you the merits of this place. In the goodly quiet of this sky castle of Junpan, high above dark clouds gather. Deep blue and far below flows the river Tsan. At my back, the red rock of heaven rises. At my feet, wild flowers bloom, vibrant and profuse. At my cave's edge, wild beasts roam and roar and grunt. In the sky, vultures and eagles circle freely, while from heaven drifts the drizzling rain. Bees hum and buzz with their chanting. Mares and foals gamble and gallop wildly. The brook chatters past pebbles and rocks. Through the trees, monkeys leap and swing, and larks carol in sweet song. The timely sounds I hear are all my fellows. The merits of this place are inconceivable. I now relate them to you in this song. O good patrons, pray follow my path and my example. Abandon evil and practice good deeds. Spontaneously from my heart, I give you this instruction. So where's the instruction? The instruction, of course, is abandon evil and practice good deeds. In other words, live an ethical life, a basic Buddhist principle. But what has he done? He's communicated what happens when you do that. He's communicated the simplicity and the beauty that occurs if you live an ethical life. So his teaching is both an illustration of the result of it and a very practical, pithy teaching to follow. Abandon evil and practice good deeds. This is what the Buddha taught. Actually, that's all you need to know. But we need things to be a bit more complicated, don't we? I'm going to read another example now. Another occasion. On this particular occasion, he's talking to five demons. They're Indian demons. I don't know why they're Indian demons. I've never been able to figure that out. But they have eyes the size of saucers. Anyway, they've come into his cave and they're taking up all the space. So he's trying to get them to go away. He tries in different ways. Eventually, he succeeds. But this is what he says to them. This lonely spot where stands my hut is a place pleasing to the Buddhas. A place where accomplished beings dwell. A refuge where I dwell alone. Above Red Rock Jewel Valley, white clouds are gliding. Below, the Tsang River gently flows. Wild vultures wheel between. Bees are humming among the flowers, intoxicated by their fragrance. In the trees, birds swoop and dart, filling the air with their song. In Red Rock Jewel Valley, young sparrows learn to fly. Monkeys love to leap and swing, and beasts to run and race. While I practice the two Bodhi minds and love to meditate. Ye local demons, gods and ghosts, all friends of Milarepa, drink the nectar of kindness and compassion, then return to your abodes. So again, another one-line teaching here, really. While I practice the two Bodhi minds, you won't worry about that for the moment, and love to meditate. So he's also saying meditation. This too leads to this same kind of experience. So practicing meditation, he's touching on the second of the great stages of the spiritual life. And I'll read one more, just to complete the trilogy. One day some villagers from Ragma come to see Milarepa and they ask him, "Why do you like this place so much? What is it that makes you so happy here? Pray tell us." Milarepa sings, "Here is the Bodhi place, quiet and peaceful. The snow mountain, the dwelling place of deities, stands high above. Below, far from here in the village, my faithful patrons live. Surrounding it are mountains nestling in white snow. In the foreground stand wish-fulfilling trees. In the valley lie vast meadows blooming wild. Around the pleasant, sweet-scented lotus, insects hum. Along the banks of the stream and in the middle of the lake, cranes bend their necks, enjoying the scene and are content. On the branches of the trees, wild birds sing. When the wind blows gently, slowly dances the weeping willow. On the treetops, monkeys bound and leap in joy. In the green, wild pastures, graze the scattered herds, and merry shepherds, gay and free from worry, sing cheerful songs and play upon their reeds. People of the world, with burning desires and craving, distracted by affairs, become the slaves of earth. From the top of resplendent gem rock, I, the yogi, see these things. Observing them, I know that they are fleeting and transient. Contemplating them, I realize that comforts and pleasure are merely mirages and water reflections. I see this life as a conjuration and a dream. Great compassion arises in my heart for those without this truth. The food I eat is space void. My meditation is dhyana, beyond distraction. Myriad visions and various feelings all appear before me. Strange indeed are samsaric phenomena. Truly amazing are the dharmas in the three worlds. Oh, what a wonder, what a marvel. Void is their nature, yet everything is manifested. So here again we see a similar sort of evocation of the beauty of nature, but this time backed by wisdom, backed by this understanding that everything is void, everything is empty of self-nature, everything is ultimately suffering. However, it's also manifested, it's also beautiful, it's also seen. This combination of seeing the void and manifestation at the same time is core to Melarepa's teaching. So you know that the rose will die, but nonetheless you appreciate its beauty. The trick is knowing that it's going to die. I just thought, I mean, incidentally, in the West, we've really only been introduced to this idea of nature being beautiful for the last couple of hundred years. It was the Romantics, really, who introduced this idea. Before the end of the 18th century, people were afraid of nature. Nature was a fearful place. It was dangerous. There was no security there. So the forests and the mountains were dangerous places. In Asia, it seems that it wasn't. Well, it was still, they were dangerous places, but it was a place where hermits could go and find beauty and find liberation. And of course, the Romantics also discovered that. Even in Shakespeare's time, the forest was a place of chaos and confusion, as in Midsummer's Night Dream, Twelfth Night, Cymbeline, various others as well. People go off into the forest because it's chaotic, but out of that chaos comes some resolution. Anyway, this is what we're aiming for, if you like. This is what we're going for, the beauty of the of liberation, the beauty of renunciation. But Milarepa points out the dangers of samsara. In order to go to those mountains, whether real or metaphorical, we have to leave the world. This is one of the palatable things about Buddhism. Samsara, we're told, is ultimately dukkha. It's ultimately unsatisfactory. So we do have to leave it. We're not going to drop it immediately, I know from my own experience, but this is what we're trying to do. So Milarepa just reminds us of a few dangers of samsara. And we'll just look at a few of those. Milarepa, in this story, he's gone down to a village. He's been approached by a married couple who are happily married, at least before they met Milarepa. And because they're happy, they see he's happy, they want to draw him into their world. So they offer him a home. And this is what he said. Home and land at first seem pleasant, but they are like a rasp filing away one's body, word and mind. I love that, a rasp. You know, rasps just take off a little bit at a time, don't they? You know, we think life is going to be so pleasurable, and gradually, bit by bit, it gets sort of scraped away. How toilsome ploughing and digging can become. How toilsome to catch the bus or the train every day to the same tedious job. And when the seeds you planted sprout, when the seeds you planted never sprout, you have worked for nothing. In the end, it becomes a land of misery, desolate and unprotected, a place of hungry spirits and haunting ghosts. When I think of this storehouse for storing sinful deeds, it gnaws at my heart. In such a prison of intransigency, I will not stay. I have no wish to join your family. The The married couple said, well, please don't talk like that. We'll find you a fine girl from a prominent family who is fit to be your bride and who will suit your taste. Please consider this. Milarepa sang, at first, a lady is a heavenly angel. We know that. The more you look at her, the more you want to gaze. Middle-aged, she becomes a demon with corpse's eyes. You say one word to her, she shouts back too. She pulls your hair and hits your knee. You strike her with your staff, but back she throws a ladle. At life's end, she becomes an old cow with no teeth. Her angry eyes burn with devilish fire, penetrating deep into your heart. I keep away from women to avoid fights and quarrels. For the young bride you mentioned, I have no appetite. Anyway, it goes through a similar kind of comment about sons, daughters, relatives. And then finally, the family's beginning to get a bit converted by this. And they say, well, look, okay, well, we're going to leave home. We're going to give you everything. You can have all our money, everything. Milarepa says, wealth, at first, leads to self-enjoyment. But then it makes other people envious. However much one has, one never feels it's enough. Until one is bound by the miser's demon. It is then hard to spend it on virtuous deeds. Wealth provokes enemies and stirs up ghosts. One works hard to gather riches which others will spend. In the end, one struggles for life and death. To amass wealth and money invites enemies. So I renounce the delusions of samsara to become the victim of deceitful devils. I have no appetite. So he puts it straight. He's got a sense of humour. But the more one thinks about these things, in a way, the more you realise his truth. The things that we hope for never really quite give us what we think they will. So he's encouraging us to leave. In other places, he talks quite a lot about status as well. I couldn't find a pithy enough reading to illustrate it. But he does talk about status, particularly in reference to priests, yogis, and scholars. So he's quite often picking on Buddhist priests, Buddhist yogis, and Buddhist scholars, telling them that they're getting caught up in status and fame and those sorts of things, rather than in practicing the Dharma. And with them, he can be particularly hard-hitting. So I've got about 5 minutes left. I'm going to skip along here. In other places, Milarepa really teaches the urgency of practicing the Dhamma. The people he's talking to and us also, I think in a way we can see the need. We can see, in fact, a desire. Presumably all of us have got some kind of desire for liberation, some kind of freedom from these bonds of samsara. But those bonds are very, very strong. And so we tend to procrastinate. We tend to, all of us tend to procrastinate. So he quite often encourages people, he reminds them that time is short. You know, you never know when you're going to get seriously ill. You never know when you're going to die. And you certainly don't realise when you're young that you're going to get old. And believe me, when you start to get old, it starts to come on pretty damn fast. You sort of notice it coming on very, very fast. So don't wait. I'm giving a talk at a school, and these kids have asked me if there's anything I regret. The only thing I regret is not living more intensely earlier. Not living my life more intensely. I don't regret any particular action, but I do regret not living it more intensely. Of just sort of, you know, making it too sort of soft, not really sort of engaging as fully as I could have done. Right from my youth, I think I've been too half-hearted. So again, I would encourage those of you, particularly those of you who've got some time left, to sort of not live whole, you know, not live half-heartedly. Live intensely. Use every second that you can. And don't waste it on samsaric things. They won't work in the end. Try and practice the Dharma intensely. Milarepa was very forthright in his communication with some people. Well, we've heard what he said to that family. I think that will do as an example. I mean, he doesn't mince his words. I've got a couple of others here, but I don't think I have time for them. But he can really kind of hammer it in. There's one, I was going to talk about one old lady he met who wasn't going to give him any alms because she hated him. And he really laid into her. Really, really, really laid into her. But at the end, she broke down and she said, yes, what you're saying is true. It's true. And, you know, so I don't think he was being just nasty. It was an example of his very fierce friendship and compassion. And I think this is perhaps a good example to us. Okay, maybe we shouldn't lay in the same way that Milarepa does. Maybe we're not confident enough of our own positivity to do something like that. But at least let's try and not be too soft with our friends. Let's try and encourage them and to point out, you know, when they're letting themselves down, you know, when they could do better in their practice. Be a bit more courageous, a bit more, not worry too much if people don't like us. I really love people to like me. I don't like doing things that make people dislike me. But that is another failing, actually. There's another thing I should have done different in my life, been a bit more sort of, a bit more edgy, and that helps people. Okay, he also talked a bit about meditation. Can I read two more songs?
Of course.
Yeah. I'm going to read one about meditation. He's teaching one of his main disciples. This disciple has learned to see that he has no self. He's gained an insight into the fact that he has no self. Milarepa says to him, "When you sought the I, you could not find it. This is the practice of the non-ego of personality. If you want to practice the non-ego of existence, follow my example and for 12 years meditate, and then you will understand the nature of mind. Think well on this, dear boy." Mm. Now, I think that's a very useful reminder, because in the course of our practice, we can gain insights. We can gain insights into the fact that we don't have a self. We can understand that. But to gain insight into the true nature of existence, according to Milarepa, for a very good disciple, takes another 12 years of meditation. So we shouldn't leap to conclusions that we're, you know, fully enlightened too early. I say this because I've seen it happen and I've known it happen. Anyway, after a few years, the boy comes back to Milarepa, and he receives this teaching. "I bow down at the feet of Marpa, who received grace from Naropa and Madripa." That's his teachers. "Those who practice the Dharma with their mouths talk much and seem to know much teaching. But when the time comes for the perceiver to leave the deadened body, the mouth-bound preacher into space is thrown." This is his criticism of scholars. "When the clear light shines in meditation, it is cloaked by..." Oh, sorry, no. When the clear light shines at death, it is cloaked by blindness. The chance to see the Dharmakaya at the time of death is lost through fear and confusion. Even though one spends the life studying the canon, it helps not at the moment of the mind's departure. Then he goes on to say, alas, those proficient yogis who long have practiced meditation mistake the psychic experience of illumination for transcendental wisdom and are happy with this form of self-deception. Therefore, when at death the transcendental wisdom of the Dharmakaya shines, these yogis cannot unify the light of mother and son. These are tantric terms. Since meditation cannot help them as they die, they are still in danger of birth in the lower realms. My dear son, best of laymen, listen to me carefully. When your body is rightly posed and your mind absorbed in meditation, you may feel that thought and mind both disappear. Yet this is but the surface experience of dhyana. By constant practice of meditation thereon, one feels radiant self-awareness shining like a brilliant lamp. It is pure and bright as a flower. It is like the feeling of staring into the vast and empty space. The awareness of voidness is limpid and transparent, yet vivid. This non-thought, this radiant and transparent experience, is but the feeling of dhyana. With this good foundation, one should further pray to the three precious ones, Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, and penetrate to reality by deep thinking and concentration. He thus can tie the non-ego wisdom with the beneficial life rope of deep dhyana. With the power of kindness and compassion, and with the altruistic vow of the Bodhi heart, he can see direct and clear the truth of the enlightened path, of which nothing can be seen, yet all is clearly visioned. He sees how wrong were the fears and hopes of his own mind. Without arrival, he reaches the place of the Buddha. Without seeing, he visions the Dharmakaya. Without effort, he does all things naturally. Dear son, the virtue seeker, bear this instruction in your mind. I was going to make some comments about that, but I won't. I'm just going to go on and read one last reading. I bow down at the feet of Marpa, the gracious one. Because I have left my kinsmen, I am happy. Because I have abandoned attachment to my country, I am happy. Since I disregard this place, I am happy. As I do not wear the lofty garb of priesthood, I am happy. Because I cling not to house and family, I am happy. I need not this or that, so I am happy. Because I possess the great wealth of Dhanama, I am happy. Because I worry not about property, I am happy. Because I have no fear of losing anything, I am happy. Since I never dread exhaustion, I am happy. Having fully realized mind essence, I am happy. As I need not force myself to please my patrons, I am happy. Having no fatigue or weariness, I am happy. As I need prepare for nothing, I am happy. Since all I do complies with Dharma, I am happy. Never desiring to move, I am happy. As the thought of death brings me no fear, I am happy. Bandits, thieves and robbers never molest me, so at all times I am happy. Having won the best conditions for Dharma practice, I am happy. Having ceased from evil deeds and left off sinning, I am happy. Treading the path of merits, I am happy. Divorced from hate and injury, I am happy. Having lost all pride and jealousy, I am happy. Understanding the wrongness of the eight worldly winds, I am happy. Absorbed in quiet and even-mindedness, I am happy. Using the mind to watch the mind, I am happy. Without hope or fear, I am happy. In the sphere of non-clinging illumination, I am happy. The non-distinguishing wisdom of Dharma Dhatu is itself happy. Poised in the natural realm of immanence, I am happy. in letting the six groups of consciousness go by to return to their original nature, I am happy. The five radiant gates of sense all make me happy. To stop the mind that comes and goes is happy. Oh, I have so much of happiness and joy. This is a song of gaiety I sing. This is a song of gratitude to my guru and the three precious ones. I want no other happiness. Through the grace of the Buddha and the gurus, food and clothes are provided by my patrons. With no bad sins or deeds, I shall be joyful when I die. With all good deeds and virtues, I am happy while alive. Enjoying yoga, I am indeed most happy. But how are you, Rucchunpa? Rucchunpa was his disciple. We'll leave it there.